David Schreiner Kahn, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Fortunately, you've come to the right place. Every expert I interview on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep people stuck. Today's interview is with Joanne Rogovin. Joanne is an expert in organizational change, leadership, and team development. She has many years of experience with all kinds of organizations, and it's my pleasure to welcome Joanne Rogovin to the show. Joanne, welcome.
Thank you, David. I'm delighted to be here.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and some of the kinds of things that you've been involved in over the course of your career?
Certainly. Well, I was born in New York. I graduated from Boston University with a bachelor's in political science, a master's in communications. I taught briefly in New York and then moved to Boston, where I became very active in the civil rights movement and the women's movement, and was asked to be the first director of affirmative action at Children's Hospital in Boston. And I realized very quickly, working there, that the issue wasn't about statistics, it was about behavior. And so I really switched my focus to developing leadership skills in the organization, and that made a significant change. From there, I went to Wall Street. For about 12 years, I worked at the New York Stock Exchange and at Kidder Peabody, and in both cases, I was responsible for organizational change and effectiveness, executive development, leadership development, and again, worked on helping people break down the barriers between being successful and being isolated from each other. I left in 1992 and got an MSW, Master's in Social Work, and then went back into some consulting. And in 1997, I joined IBM as an executive consultant, working only with the very senior executives of the organization on helping them better steward the organization. I retired from IBM and started to work with an organization called the Center for Secondary School Redesign, which works with high-poverty, large, underperforming high schools to create what we call smaller learning communities so that there is more personal attention and if I can use the word, intimacy in the experience. And so, and that's where I am.
Wow. Sounds like not only a varied career, but a really fascinating one.
It has been, and I feel very fortunate because I've worked with some of the smartest, nicest people I can imagine. I've traveled the world and done all of this work internationally, so it's been a very fulfilling career.
So I have a question. How common is it for someone who has been involved in civil rights and in particular affirmative action to end up being in a role where you're providing guidance and advice for some of the senior people in the in some of the most influential corporate settings in America?
It's a great question. I wasn't sure how that was going to work out, and yet people seem to be very intrigued not only by that, but by the fact that I left Wall Street and went and got a master's in social work. And the truth is that some of the best consultants I've ever worked with and some of the best people I've ever hired had either MSWs or degrees in psychology or degrees in organizational behavior. So all of that around more of the behavioral part of the work rather than what I would call more the management of the organization. And that seems to have a lot of resonance with people. It's not like getting an MBA. It's a very different, it's the other side of that coin. And it has been an area that people were intrigued about when we interviewed, and it's never been a barrier. It's, in fact, been a plus.
Do you think it's as common today as it was when you were climbing your personal career ladder for people to have backgrounds in organizational, psychological, or social work skills as opposed to the more technical business skills?
I don't know quite how to answer that, but I think that there is, in some ways, a little disaffection with only the MBA strategic thinking, do it by the numbers, because I think we've learned, and I have to credit Daniel Goleman when he wrote Emotional Intelligence, with really opening people's eyes to the fact that we are much more connected to and driven by how we feel, as opposed to being logical and rational and all those things that we think we are. And so I think that there has been more awareness of the fact that a good leader has to be emotionally tuned in, has to understand what it takes to motivate people. And so I think there's more acceptance and awareness and the recognition of the need for this.
Well, I can tell you my colleagues in the marketing world are certainly very clued into the emotional reaction of potential customers, much more so than the rational or thinking part of potential customers.
So the question is, do they turn that awareness inside and deal with their employees with that same sensitivity and awareness that they do with the client they're trying to influence?
That's right. So what's the answer?
Mostly no. Most of the time, business owners, whether they're small business owners or large business owners, are really focused on the financial goals, hitting the target, improving the bottom line. And so they become very driven by that, and that's fine. That's part of their job. But the other part of their job is to grab the attention, the hearts and mind, if you will, of the people working for them and with them, and make sure that they are as engaged in the success as the small business owner and leader is, in terms of contributing to the company. If I can tell you just a little anecdote, I was working with a very small company, and even though it was small, they were very compartmentalized. There were lots of little silos all over the place, and so we brought everybody together for a problem-solving and planning session, and it turned out to be very, very, very successful, and I will tell you we did some creative, ice-breaking kinds of things to kind of loosen up the creativity. And at the end of the session, somebody came up to me and said, you know, they've had my hands for 8 years. They could have had my brain all that time, too. And it was a real turnaround. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, why do you think leaders don't pay as much attention to the emotional aspect of their employees as they might to their customers?
I think they're uncomfortable. I think they're worried that if they know too much about an employee, that they will get there will be a bias, or there will be too much attachment, or they won't be able to manage and direct people and require them to perform in a certain way. And I learned a really good lesson. One of my very first jobs where I had to manage a whole team, and I ended up hiring a very close friend because she was absolutely perfect for this job. And we sat down and talked, and I said, what goes on in terms of work is I'm your manager, you work for us, there are going to be certain requirements, and I will have to give you feedback if something isn't good, and I can assure you I will praise you to the roof when something is good. And she was fine about that, and it never got muddied. And I think those are the kinds of things that bosses get concerned about, that they will get there'll be too much sentiment, if you will, in their work. And it doesn't have to happen that way. You can absolutely set the guidelines. Consultants and coaches can help our leaders find ways to be more comfortable with opening themselves up, with being more transparent with their employees, with engaging people in idea generation and so on, and not worry about the fact that it'll get emotional or out of hand or too familiar.
I think that's great advice.
Thank you.
So, Joanne, how do you define leadership?
Well, you know, there are a lot of definitions of leadership, and I think that at its core, it's inspiring people to do and be their best in the interest of the company's success. I mean, we can't forget that there's a bottom line here. And so we don't want people coming in and just putting in their time. And I don't know anybody, really, who would say, oh, I think I'll go to work and do a mediocre job. But we need to have leadership that we can believe in and that gives us, you know, a reason to be our best. I think being a leader takes courage to take risks and to be open to innovation and change. And, of course, a good leader has to have business and management savvy, but that's really not enough. They need to be thinking ahead, and that's very hard. We all get into a firefighting position. It's hard work being a leader and a manager. And if you have a small company, you don't have 1,000 people to delegate things to. You might have 6 or 10 or 20. And so it's very easy to get bogged down into the day-to-day things. And a leader needs to learn how to extricate him or herself enough to be able to think forward. So that's part of my definition.
Are there examples from your own experience providing guidance to top leadership in big companies that we can apply for smaller organizations?
I think absolutely. If I can tell you a story, now IBM is certainly not a small organization. One of the leaders I had been working with had taken over a very, very large region of the organization very suddenly. Whoever was there left, and it was 24 hours. This person got on a plane and went a long way to do this. And he called me and said, we're stuck. We are absolutely stuck. We need to generate not only more business, but different kinds of businesses here. We're not getting ahead of what we need to get ahead of. And I will say that to his credit, he was definitely a risk taker. We did some very, I think, what people might have called slightly off the wall introductory things. And I have to tell you, we had people from 3 or 4 different cultures in the room, made it a little risky. But I did a version of something called Synectics, which is a metaphor-driven process by which you take something not related to the business, think about its characteristics, its pluses, its minuses, and then work a series of dialogues in which you see how those characteristics connect to the business you're trying to drive. I mean, it's very hard to say in the abstract. And it was something nobody had ever experienced. We ended up, after 3.5 days, creating 3 fully formed new businesses, which went on to be extraordinarily successful. And so it was shaking the trees is one part of it. But the other thing is, and I think this is another important characteristic of a good leader, this particular person said, I think this is a great idea. Let's try it, and if for some reason it doesn't work, the buck stops here. I approved it. I own it. I will fly air cover for you. And so having the courage and the, not just the courage, the integrity to say, go do it, and I'm with you, and there are no negative consequences for trying this. Let's do it. So I think that was an extreme, and these were very competent people, very experienced people, and stuck. Characterological, it's hard to teach that, but that competency, that capability can be reinforced through coaching, through experience, and sometimes we as consultants and coaches can simply give a leader permission to do that. They think they have to be right all the time. It's a terrible burden. And by acknowledging that, okay, we're going to take this chance and I'm in it with you, opens up a lot of innovation and creativity in the people in the organization.
And it may not just be about the leader being right or wrong, but also the leader being willing to accept failure of something that happens on the team, where a team member may try something that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And don't we want people who are part of our teams to feel comfortable taking calculated risks? Otherwise, how is the company going to get out of its own plateau or the place where it's stuck?
That's absolutely right. So that's one of the things that I think really highly respected, recognized leaders do. They say, we've got to try something new. If we're going to grow, if we're going to provide, not only grow, we're going to provide the products and services that a very changing environment is going to demand of us, we'd better get ahead of it and be innovative and think forward. I'm not going to say out of the box, I hate that, but think in different ways.
Well, standing still is generally not an option.
Exactly.
Because the environment around you is constantly changing.
Yeah. And the thing about change over the last decade or more is that it has been nonlinear. It's not the kind of change where you go from where you tweak a product. There have been the kinds of enormous innovations and quantum leaps in change that can leave us all reeling. And so a really effective leader should be tuned into that sort of stuff and be willing to pull in experts to do that kind of research for him or her, to keep them apprised of what's going on. Nobody can do it all. It's not possible. So that's how I think about good leaders.
That's great. So, Joanne, you've talked a lot about how different kinds of help can work with leadership to encourage, advise, and help them smash the plateau and get unstuck.
Mm-hmm.
How do leaders find the right kind of help for a given situation? If I'm a leader, how do I know what to look for, who to look for, what questions to ask, etc.?
Well, there are two things that are two parts of the answer. First of all, successful leaders get stuck because they're successful, and they figure that they must be right, and they continue to do the same thing when things are changing, as we just said. So they become legends in their own minds, and they get stuck. So how do they find the kind of help they're looking for? I know that most of the work I do, well, when you're internal to an organization, it's easy. They know you're there, and if you have some credibility, they will call you. As an entrepreneur and as an external consultant and coach, I find that there are several ways in which they can find us. One is that they ask their friends. Who do you work with? And who has been successful? They go online and look for consultants and coaches and read their blogs and read their recommendations and learn about their background. And all of us offer people a free consultation, a short consultation, a conversation, an assessment of what's going on. So they're at low risk by asking people for help. There are a lot of successful, really good coaches who come out of academia. And if you look at a lot of business schools, universities, schools of psychology, there are excellent people. There are wonderful books. You can look at books on leadership and look at the addendum, the glossary, the index, and see who they're referencing. So there are lots and lots of ways. Most of us do speaking at conferences. You go to a conference that's in your field, and you can hear people that you think are worthwhile. There's no excuse to say, I don't know who to ask for help. And so I think that that's that it's a lot of just asking and doing some research. And I have hired consultants mostly because I've either heard about them or they sent me an article that they'd written that was compelling, or they were dogged about making appointments and coming in with new things all the time until I said, okay, you're it. So there are lots of ways to find consultants.
What role, you know, one of the things that we see with people who are in leadership roles is that they often feel very isolated, which might sound counterintuitive because here they are dealing with people all the time. But in actual fact, what we generally see is that the person at the top of an organizational pyramid generally doesn't talk with other people about certain things, particularly when it involves risk-taking and that they might feel fearful about taking certain steps. So they're not going to speak with their employees about these fears. If they have people inside the company who are in an advisory capacity, they might talk with them about certain things but not others. They often don't speak with their personal significant other, if they have one, about these issues. What ways have you seen community helping leaders to get through their own kind of break out of their own box when they feel like they're not sure they want to take a certain step and there are things they might like to have some feedback on, or maybe some community of like-minded people? Are there ways that they can tap into those communities or build those communities for themselves and help themselves smash the plateau?
Absolutely. I think that the worst myth, and hopefully it's going away, is that of the heroic leader, the one man or woman band who has to take everything, all the responsibilities, and some of the glory for being a leader. So I think building a community both with employees and outside advisors is a strength, not a weakness. So I've worked in situations, for example, where we set up joint meetings between suppliers and customers with the organization, with the sales team. We've set up joint collaborations and meetings between research, sales, and service, because there would be situations where a salesperson comes in and says, the customer wants X, and the research people says, you can't bend metal that way, you know? So I've been in that company. I was in that conversation. It was a high-tech company. Anyway, so getting those people together off-site every once a year or so made a tremendous difference.
Community is so important when you're trying to make any kind of change effort.
Oh, you can't do it alone. The only thing I will say about doing a major change effort is you have to have active, visible leadership from the top of the house. It can't start in the middle. There are a lot of wonderful things that can start at the bottom and at the middle, but if you're going to do major change in an organization, which always impacts the whole culture of the organization and how people do things in the organization, you need to have visible, active, ongoing presence of the leader. And they don't have to do it themselves.
Right. The leader, yeah, the leader sets the tone.
Right. Absolutely. Yep.
So, Joanne, shifting gears for a moment, can you give us an example from your own career where you've gotten stuck? stuck and how you've gotten unstuck?
Oh, you mean personally?
Yes.
Okay. I had a job, again, with a Wall Street firm, which will remain nameless. No matter what we tried to do that was innovative, there was no appetite for it, although I was brought in to be the vice president of organizational development and change. And I did something fairly dramatic since I did not have anything to go to, but I walked into my boss one day and said, I'm too well to work here. I quit. And so that's not everybody's answer about getting unstuck. The other, but it was appropriate because the organization was very punishing, and I didn't want to stay there. The other ways that I have gotten unstuck is to go back to school. And I'm not talking about my master's. I'm saying when I was at a point where I felt I was repeating myself, or that I was just not being as creative or innovative or open, I went back to school. I would take a course. I would go to a conference. I would go to a workshop. I would do things that would trigger my imagination and that would re-energize me. And that's, I think, a good thing for business owners to do, too, to get out of the office, to go to conferences, to go to meetings with other professionals, whether they join an organization of heads of small companies or some sort of a leadership council or whatever, to be around people who are not so zeroed into their own business and work and to hear other things. I have found that to be enormously generative of new ideas and new energy.
Which is also part of being involved in a community of like-minded people.
Absolutely, and sometimes a community of not so like-minded people, you know. So you go to some sort of a meeting or a conference or a discussion of a subject that's not directly engaged with your work, but that sounds like maybe there's something creative or interesting or new ideas. I don't even have to agree with them, but I'm going to open myself to some new ideas. So I just think that, getting yourself out of that seat and into the broader world, and I'm not saying it's easy. It's not easy because, as we said before, a business leader is just drowning in details and decisions and so on. But we all need to get, we need to unstick ourselves and go and hear new ideas.
Do you see any difference in trends of leadership in large corporations versus small business?
You know, people are people. And I think we all need the same things. I've been in small companies, and I've been in a company that had 450,000 people. You want a leadership that you can trust. You want clarity about what's expected. You want your leader to remove the barriers to you doing a good job. I always felt that was part of my job as a leader and a manager, was to get the noise out of the system for my people so that they could do what they needed to do. So I think that, yeah, there are orders of magnitude that are different, but the fundamentals are the same. What do
people
you think?
Are people.
What do you
yeah,
think?
People are people.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what do you think about the future of people who help leaders, coaches, consultants, et cetera? Do you think that there are some changes that are taking place or any trends?
I think
go on the way they've been?
First of all, I think that the whole coaching world has just exploded for a number of reasons. I think that the world we live in is so complex that there is so much rapid and nonlinear change that people are finding themselves overwhelmed. I won't even start to talk about how much data we get. I don't know if it's good information, but we sure have a lot of data. We need more and more. We need people who can help bring the focus to bear on what we need to know, where we need to go, how we can get there. And so I see coaching and consulting becoming a growth industry, to say the very least. And my experience is that really good leaders and managers engage with consultants and engage with various kinds of consultants on various kinds of levels. But nobody can be know-all and do-all and be-all in this environment. And so I think that it is, I think you need to be selective. I think, of course, you need to choose somebody who is smart in the right ways for your company and where there's a cultural fit. I don't want to leave that out. I think that there are, it's important that you and the consultant, that the consultant and the leader and the organization have a certain certain cultural fit, that you see the world and possibilities in a similar way. And that's a good start for this kind of a relationship. But I think that the future is bright for both the companies and for consultants.
Is there anything that you're working on now that excites you that you'd like to discuss?
Well, I recently, I'd like to talk about something that was in the very recent past. It was an organization that had acquired a whole bunch of companies, of small companies, over a period of about a year and a half, and had integrated none of them. So the customers didn't even know that these changes had taken place. And so when a customer would call the company that they thought they were a client of, they'd hear a whole other name. Anyway, what we did there, which was really very gratifying and exciting, we rebranded the company. Because I had never, as I said, never let customers know. We had we did a rebranding. It was less sort of your traditional change management, leadership development, although everything, all of those things happened, but it was all under the umbrella of rebranding the organization. So it had a unified voice and a unified look and a unified culture, which takes a long time, of course. And unified messages, and it was very gratifying and exciting work. So that whole idea of everybody being on the same page, whether you, as I said, have 20 people or 2,000 people, it gives people a sense of confidence and purpose and a way to really go forward with a sense of purpose.
Those are all really great and important ingredients for success. So thank you for sharing that.
Oh, you're welcome.
Joanne, we're getting close to the end of our interview, and we believe one of the most vital elements to smash through any plateau in business or life is to create a community of complementary people with complementary talents, which is why we always end our interviews with this question. Who do you know that's currently doing work you're especially excited about, and why?
Well, a couple of examples. There is a nonprofit organization that serves an increasingly diverse community. It's called the Educational Alliance, and it's down on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And about a year ago, they literally upended the organization. They brought in a consultant. They took a good hard look at their customer base, the changing needs of that demographic, the programs that they were offering, what was working, what was missing, what was lacking, et cetera. And very bravely, the CEO, the executive director, just absolutely said, we are going to reinvent ourselves in a way that serves this community in a way we've never done before. I wish I had been the consultant on it. I wasn't, but I heard them talk about it, and it was really a courageous and very inclusive thing. Lots of focus groups with the community, lots of focus groups with experts, a lot of visiting other organizations to see what they were doing. And by the way, that's another thing that I'd like to mention. Leaders can learn a great deal by going to other organizations, even if they're non-competitors, in a completely other business, to see what they're doing, to benchmark what other organizations, similar in size, for example, are doing that are different and innovative. And again, a good consultant can help you identify those places and say, go take a look at these guys. They're really doing interesting stuff. And the other, from the whole other end, I think IBM is constantly reinventing itself. We used to joke about the reorganizations being rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, but that really wasn't fair because there was always a business driver for why something got reorganized. And, you know, sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't work. But there was always this attempt to say, where's the business going? Where are our clients going? Where's the technology going? And what do we need to do to be at the forefront of all of this? And so for an organization that had a reputation for being very bureaucratic, and yes, of course it was, there were more reports than you could shake your fist at, but in terms of moving the business forward, there were some terrific thinkers and some and change was just ingrained in the culture. So those are two very different examples. But in each case, the organizations opened themselves up to doing some non-linear, non-traditional things.
Great. Thank you. Those are great examples.
Well, thank you.
Our guest today, Joanne Rogovin, an expert in organizational change, leadership, and team development, who has had an illustrious career. Thank you for joining us today on Smashing the Plateau.
Thank you, David. It was a delight to be here, and I appreciate the time to talk with everyone.
You've been listening to Smashing the Plateau, the podcast produced by 10 Strategic Partners. Be sure to visit our website at smashingtheplateau.com and join our email list to hear many more great interviews like this one. And if you like what you heard, please leave us a review on iTunes by going to smashingtheplateau.com/iTunes. I'm your host, David Schreiner-Kahn, and we'll be talking again soon.